Support for the Exchange podcast from NHPR comes from you, our subscribers, and from
Dartmouth Hitchcock. Imagine nationally ranked healthcare in your community with convenient locations throughout northern New England. World-class providers are closer than you think. Visit dartmouthhitchcock.org to learn more. Dartmouth Hitchcock is here. And from
the Elm Street Group at Morgan Stanley, working with clients to create enduring financial value and a lasting impact through sustainable investing solutions. A local wealth management team with global insights. Find out more at the Elm Street Group at morganstanley.com.
From New Hampshire Public Radio, I'm Josh Rogers. This is the weekly New Hampshire News Roundup on the Exchange. The New Hampshire Senate passes a state, the New Hampshire Senate Finance Committee passes a state budget. Vermont Governor Phil Scott says no to legal pot. St. Paul's School releases a report detailing faculty sexual abuse stretching back for decades. Lawmakers look to Keno as a way to fund full-day kindergarten. And the state GOP goes on offense after an Associated Press reporter attended and apparently misreported some details of a private fundraiser. And contrary to whatever Fish and Game says, Governor Chris Sununu promises the state won't be killing the bears on the prowl in Hanover. Lots and lots to discuss this week on the Roundup, joined today by Dan Barrick from here at NHPR, Kevin Landergan of the New Hampshire Union Leader, and Dean Spiliotis, Southern New Hampshire University. Why don't we start with St. Paul's School, which issued a 73-page report by an outside law firm. It said that 13 former faculty members committed abuse occurring from the 1940s to the 1980s. In the wake of reports out of other prep schools, Choate Rosemary Hall in Connecticut, St. George's in Rhode Island, and Phillips Exeter here in New Hampshire. It's hard to see this as terribly shocking, isn't it, Dean?
Yeah, no, it's not shocking. You know, as you mentioned, a number of elite boarding schools have been reporting these kinds of abuses, many of them stretching back 20, 30, even 40 years. You know, St. Paul's been in the news a lot recently because of the Owen LaBrie trial. That's ongoing. I think he still has one of two appeals still pending. He's also, I think, recently asked to have the law about online use of computers and sex offender registries reconsidered. So there's a lot going on there. And this was a longer look going back 40 years. I think they highlighted something like 36 examples of sexual abuse. Apparently, some concerns were brought to the school in 2000 and not given sufficient attention. So you're seeing around the country a lot of the nation's top boarding and prep schools doing some real introspection and trying to figure out how to move forward with this.
I mean, some of the details in this report, I mean, the report mentioned two suicides, one of a boy teased by classmates over being a victim back in the 40s, and another instance, a girl, and there were apparently two girls who were involved in sexual relationships with male teachers who they later married. One of those girls killed herself on the same day that her husband died of a heart attack. Those were new sorts of incidents, as well as a lot of typical ones. You know, one that stood out was an incident where a girl groped by a prominent teacher at the school. And per this outside report, a very prominent abuser, Lawrence Katzenbach, went to a dean and spoke of being touched by this teacher, who apparently asked her, "What did you do to make him do that?" And, you know, the through line of this is that a lot of the students felt that the school was more interested in protecting its reputation than students did.
Yeah, the report was fairly thorough. I mean, it came as a bit of a surprise. There was no lead up to this. The school simply released it. Those cases where they found substantiated claims, as you indicated, Josh, were quite detailed and in some places quite graphic. And I imagine the school thought that if not that they would, you know, put an end to this story, at least be able to turn a page. And the days since then, I think there's the response has been interesting. On the one hand, locally, you've seen the Concord Police Department actually voice a little bit of skepticism about some of the aspects of this report, including the school's claim that there's been no credible instances of staff or faculty sexual misconduct since the year 2000. The local police have also been going through their own criminal reports to see how they line up with the school's accounting of some of these instances. And you've also seen this is sort of not necessarily tied to this instance of student and faculty misconduct, but the Owen LaBrie case, which obviously got a lot of local attention, the senior student who was convicted of sexually assaulting a fellow student, a freshman girl, last year. That girl, that woman, now Chessie Prout, and her family, who are actually suing the school in civil court over their handling of her instance, have used this report as a way to call attention to what they describe as the continuing culture of reputation, putting the school's reputation ahead of the safety of the students. So the report continues to, I think, raise some questions about just the school's culture and its continuing response.
Well, and how the state handles this in light of the pending lawsuit is interesting. The defense that the school has given thus far to the allegations of the family of Chessie Prout that the school was at fault for insufficiently protecting students was that, you know, the school couldn't do anything to have avoided that situation or other situations. Obviously, this report suggests that the school is acknowledging that it fell short in the past. Why don't we listen to what St. Paul's rector, Michael Hirschfeld, said this week?
What I'd like to say to those who are affected is we're sorry. The school is sorry. I'm sorry as the head of school. Deeply painful for the entire community. We're gonna try to continue to be inspired by the courage of those people who came forward to make the school a better place.
All right. That's St. Paul's rector Michael Hirschfeld trying to continue to be inspired by those who have come forward to make the school a better place. Interesting if we're going to hear a similar line from St. Paul's during that Prout case, should that make it to trial. Dan mentioned, Kevin, that the school said that there was no abuse since 2000, but the report also said that several faculty were removed for what were described as boundary issues. And, you know, that's obviously something that the police are probably going to be looking at.
Yeah, and certainly 2000 was an important year, since, as Dean pointed out, in 2000 at a reunion, a bunch of students essentially lodged a kind of dossier about sexual abuse that they either encountered or witnessed back in the 1970s. And the report indicates that the college wasn't interested in getting at the truth or interested in helping the victims, but rather interested in protecting the school's reputation. So I think that's why Concord PD, this is in 2000 now. So I think that's why the Concord PD says, well, wait a minute, nothing's happened since 1988. You people were 12 years later trying to sweep under the rug allegations at the time. The other thing, interesting point, is we find out as a result of this report, and not before then, that St. Paul's School went to the legislature and tried to change the state law with regard to the statute of limitations on filing abuse claims. Right now, once you reach age 40, you cannot make a criminal claim for sexual abuse. And the age is 30 for a civil claim. Now, the legislation St. Paul's School was seeking was to remove the statute of limitations for a criminal charge, but not to remove it for a civil charge. That obviously becomes important here. As we know, the likelihood that whatever happens with the Owen LaBrie appeal, that we're likely to see a civil lawsuit against St. Paul's School with regard to Chessie Prout.
Yeah, and the challenge for a lot of these schools, like a St. Paul's or Exeter or St. George's or Choate, that historically the first impulse has been to protect the elite reputation, circle the wagons. The way these things are dealt with tends to be very opaque. And so it's going to be interesting to see if they really, you know, was this report an attempt to kind of put an end to things or really sort of a first step for kind of transforming the culture. And, you know, we all know people who attend these schools and you hear a lot about, you know, sort of what really goes on campus and the extent to which they feel that the administrations are or are not being responsive. And I think, you know, at a number of these schools, from talking to people, there's still a long way to go.
Well, why don't we take a listen to what attorney Eric McLeish told NHPR this week. He's an attorney who's represented clients in clergy sex abuse cases against the Catholic Church, against St. George's School in Rhode Island, a school, by the way, that both McLeish and I attended. He's substantially older than I am. Why don't we take a listen to what he told us this week?
What you see in many cases is, and you saw this in the St. George's case and the Choate case, these reports, they come out, and that spurs other victims to come forward. And so I think you're going to see some other names that may be mentioned in the weeks ahead. One of the people that I represent is going to actually speak with the rector, I think, in the next couple of weeks. So, you know, he would prefer to have it go through St. Paul's before it comes out in the news media. But there will be some other names.
All right. That was attorney Eric McLeish, who apparently will be representing some clients, former students at St. Paul's School, where graduation weekend is coming up next weekend. Alumni are going to be back for reunions obviously plenty for folks to think and talk about. Stay tuned there and certainly give us a call. The exchange number is 1-800-892-6477. Email is exchange@nhpr.org or at NHPR Exchange on Facebook and Twitter. Joined this week by Kevin Landergan, the New Hampshire Union leader, Dan Barrack from here at NHPR, and Dean Spiliotis, Southern New Hampshire University. Why don't we drive back down Pleasant Street towards the State House, where the Senate Finance Committee finished its work on the budget. Certainly lots of issues requiring money this year, mental health, DCYF, I could go on, but also a reasonably healthy situation economically. The revenue picture is pretty good, although before the Finance Committee did its work, the Ways and Means Committee needed it to do its work, setting the amount of money that the Finance Committee would have to write the budget, and that was fairly fractious. Why do you think that was, Kevin?
Well, the chairman of the Senate Ways and Means Committee, Andy Sanborn, very conservative Republican, also someone thinking about running for Congress in 2018, and is somebody who has not only advocated for significant business tax cuts, which are also in this plan and we'll talk about, but somebody who ideologically believes in the paradigm that is New Hampshire state budgeting, which is to say you keep these state revenue estimates as low as humanly possible in order to not create momentum for more spending. And if you end up with a large rainy day fund, a guy like Andy Sanborn is fine with that. But obviously, as we've seen, coming out of this recession, the economy is recovering and is clearly a pent-up demand for more spending now that the economy is better. So even Republicans in leadership convinced that committee to revise its own estimates upward in order to generate more revenue.
Well, I was in the Ways and Means Committee when that was happening, and it was interesting. Senator Sanders, there were lots of recesses. Lots of this action took place in the hall or behind closed doors with portions of the committee. The final vote included one Democrat, Dan Feltes, joining two Republicans, Bob Guida and Gary Daniels, in support of what the Ways and Means Committee ultimately agreed to. Senator Lou D'Alessandro, the Democrat, thought that there was room for more revenues. Senator Sanborn wanted to hold fast to revenues the Republicans had adopted prior, which I think was $67 million less than what the committee ended up adopting. But Governor Sununu was involved. Senate President Chuck Morris was in and out of the room. Does this foretell any difficulty for this budget moving forward, or is this kind of a little bit of theater and a little bit of honest belief on the part of Senator Sanborn?
Oh, I think it's clearly honest belief on Senator Sanborn, but I think it reflects what we're seeing here and what we haven't seen for the last 12 years as a Republican governor and a Republican-led legislature. And what you saw there is essentially in public some of the high-level cooperation that is going to go on in order to produce a budget in, after all, a very difficult year here, as we've talked about in this program before. And a historic failure of the House to pass a budget is really required this Republican governor and this Republican Senate president to be on the same page as much as possible, because they're going to have to convince the House to go along.
That said, this is true both at the state level, and I've seen it for many years at the congressional level. When you have unified control of government, you start to see all internal factions and fractures. And so it's not surprising to me to see this kind of disagreement among Republicans. I mean, the goal, as you suggested, is to kind of figure it out before you go forward for the good of the party. But it's very common for a unified government to get bogged down because, people of the party figure, we have control of the government. This is our chance to move our agenda, whether you're a Democrat or a Republican. And there's a lot of disagreement about how to do that. It's much easier many times to be in the opposition than it is to come some kind of an agreement when you have the majority on the committees.
That said, the process in the Senate Finance Committee over the last few weeks has been remarkably smooth. I mean, I think the people with their hands on the wheel, Chuck Morris, Jeb Bradley, even on the Democratic side, Lou D'Alessandro, have been in those seats for years and years, and understand the process, understand the budget, understand the politics of it. And I think also, sort of Kevin indicated this, that after the real fiasco of the House budget process earlier in the spring, that pressure was even higher for the Senate and Governor Sununu to play a role there to really ensure smooth sailing here. But I don't think that was ever really in doubt. I mean, Chuck Morris has sort of gotten this budget writing process down, at least the process of it. One can take issue with the outcome, but the process is fairly routine for these guys at this point.
One of the things that's true, too, about what Dean was saying is that the paradigm is the same in Washington as well. Republicans always have a harder time during tough during good economies when they're in charge, because it is the edict of Republicans to live within their means. So when the economy is in recovery and there's all and governments are flush with revenue, and you're seeing this on Capitol Hill now. Trump has put out a very conservative budget outline that's not going over well, even among a lot of Republicans on Capitol Hill, who want to be able to spend more money than Trump does.
Well, and even here in the state, you see the Senate budget that came out of committee has future business tax cuts for 2019 and 2021. You know, Democrats are going to say, you know, how are you going to pay for that? And also, you know, that's revenue that could be directed towards, you know, opioid, mental health, even though the Senate budget does increase that to some extent. You know, they're going to argue that it doesn't go far enough.
Well, just in terms of the politics aside, in terms of the policies contained in the Senate budget, what's most germane here? I mean, obviously, there were, I think, $17 million set aside to boost the number of mental health beds. That's obviously been a priority of top policymakers and the governor. Dean mentioned the business tax cuts. What else is in here that people ought to pay attention to?
Well, you've certainly got the advocate that's in charge of or providing oversight to the Division of Children, Youth, and Families, which is very important. There is additional money in that agency for child service workers. The Democrats say is not enough, but certainly that was a big priority for this governor and this legislature. There is no property tax relief in this proposal. Speaker Sean Jasper wanted that desperately in his House budget, $50 million worth. Nothing there. There's also no increase for the university system in New Hampshire. They're essentially level funded, and so tuitions will probably go up in state colleges if that's ultimately the call that's made. As we've seen in the state Senate as well in the past, more money for community colleges, less of an increase for the four-year system.
Here's what Senate President Morse said yesterday in describing the budget and the process moving ahead.
It's all about building a good budget. I mean, it's, you know, I think the budget that we're sending to the floor next week is a budget that the House could concur with, to be honest with you. I think it's a good marriage between what the governor did and what the House did.
All right, that was Senate President Chuck Morse talking about his confidence that this could be a budget that the House will concur with. I guess it's good to be optimistic. But, you know, in terms of process-wise, Kevin, since the House didn't pass a budget, you know, the House obviously has to do something with it on the floor before we get to a committee of conference. You know, how do we see this playing out in the absence of a House position? I mean, the Senate has suggested it's going to allow the House to debate positions it didn't have. What do you see happening?
Yeah, well, it's certainly an open question, to be sure, because I would presume once this budget comes over from the Senate that House Democrats are going to say, we're not agreeing to this. We want more spending. And I would assume there's going to be these House Freedom Caucus members in the New Hampshire House, conservative members, who may look at this budget and say, yeah, it's got less spending than the House budget wanted, but I'm still not satisfied. So we could see a very close vote on whether to concur on this budget. And I think we've seen, as we'll just talk about here, is the House leadership as well and House budget writers. And what they're doing with the kindergarten bill is obviously trying to gain some leverage in this state budget debate.
All right. And we're going to get to the kindergarten bill after a break. But as far as this process works, Dan, it's our understanding that assuming we can get through the House, and will it require, I mean, do we think it's going to require a coalition of the sort that, that you know, got the speaker elected, or some sort of different coalition where there needs to be some Democratic support for this in order to make this happen, or can...
If that's the strategy, that's the budget coming out of the Senate doesn't look like that's the way to get there. And I think the business tax cuts are the biggest example of that, which, you know, were a big sticking point in the budget process 2 years ago. Remember, Democratic Governor Maggie Hassan vetoed the budget at the time over that and was able to get those staggered a little bit, but they were in there. And I think if nothing else, those business tax cuts might be the thing that bring on board some of those Liberty mm-hmm. caucus Republicans in the House that Kevin mentioned will come on board. We saw J.R. Hole was quoted as talking very favorably about those business tax cuts, and he was sort of the canary in the coal mine, if you remember, a few months ago, as giving an indication that there are libertarians in the House, Republican caucus, who don't like this House budget, and sure enough, that's what sank it. So I think it's got a good shot of getting through the House just with pure Republican support.
Okay, the first step is it's got to get through the Senate next week. Many miles to go before this budget sleeps. Stick around. More of the Weekly New Hampshire News Roundup in just a moment.
want to know why it is that people suggest telling your congressional representatives how you feel about the issues. Does it make a difference?
Who can answer the burning questions about government operations?
How does the Electoral College work? Is the system outdated in our current democracy system?
What is a filibuster, and what purpose does it serve in the government?
Who can help us cleave these Gordian knots?
Civics 101.
Subscribe now, wherever you get your podcasts.
Thank you.
This is the weekly New Hampshire News Roundup on the Exchange. I'm Josh Rogers. The Exchange number is 1-800-892-6477. Email is exchange at NHPR, or always find us on Facebook and Twitter at NHPR Exchange. Joined this week by Dean Spiliotis, Southern New Hampshire University, Kevin Landrigan, New Hampshire Union Leader, and Dan Barrick from here at NHPR. You know, one thing that's not in the Senate budget is kindergarten, full-day kindergarten. There was some movement on this issue this week in the House. The Finance Committee gave the bill, passed by the House Policy Committee, a bit of a haircut, attaching Keno to it. You know, Kevin, you alluded to this, but why do you think that is?
Well, certainly Keno is a subject that the House in the last several sessions has supported, and it passed the House Finance Committee 26-0, being attached to this kindergarten bill, including support from folks who've never supported Keno before. I think it indicates a strong desire on the part of House budget writers to say to the state of the Senate budget writers, essentially, we've got something you want in a separate bill. So why can't we negotiate some of the other state budget policies in a conference committee? Because to be sure, kindergarten looks like it's going to a conference committee. I can't imagine the Senate's going to adopt this. Even the supporter of the kindergarten bill in the Senate, David Waters, said, Keno's a non-starter for me. I'm not voting for that. I like the fact they're in favor of the policy. But so I think we're seeing the kind of horse trading and gamesmanship that typically goes on right now around Memorial Day of the year.
Well, you mentioned the policy, and the kindergarten policy in this bill has also changed a little bit. I mean, recall that this, when the governor proposed it, it was going to be $9 million a year targeted using a formula that would factor in property tax wealth of a district,
student need,
you know, free and reduced lunch, English as a second language. Then the House wanted to make it just a flat amount, going everybody would get some. That's a popular position in the House, where once you get into sort of divvying up what community gets what, passing things can be tough. This bill, and that bill would cost $14 million a year. This bill would send districts per pupil $1,100 per pupil on top of the $1,700 that they now get. All districts get for half day kindergarten, half count of kindergarten. So this lowers the price tag a bit, and it doesn't tie Keno directly. It doesn't say the Keno money will directly fund. It'll say Keno money will be dumped into the Education Trust Fund. And
yeah, it's essentially what, I mean, there is some symmetry to it, right? When we when we became the first state to have a state lottery more than a half century ago, we did it in order to dedicate all the profits to education. So this is essentially an expansion of the state lottery program. The state lottery, by the way, is solidly behind Keno, and for several years has been saying, hey, this is a way for us to incrementally increase our revenues in a dependable way that Keno, they think, would not be huge amounts of money, but could generate a pretty solid, say, $8 to $10 million a year.
Not surprising that Lou D'Alessandro, the senator who has sponsored a number of casino bills, said, you know, well, if you really want to do kindergarten, I've got a couple of casinos that might make funding even stronger than it is. Yeah, this is obviously not resolved yet. But when I saw it, I thought, oh, it's an interesting way to go at it. But it's certainly going to complicate things, particularly given how many times the Senate has voted against Keno in the past.
The game of chicken between casinos v. Keno, which
has been going on for a long time now.
The last two cycles has been changed a bit by the fact that, you know, the air really seems to be out of a straight up casino gambling now. And, you know, a lot of people, I guess my instinct when I learned this was like that senators might see this as a bit of a kind of thumb in the eye. And I put that question to Senator Morris, and he said, no, he doesn't see it that way. You know, he's going to get this bill into committee of conference. And obviously, Senator Waters has staked out his position. You know, I don't know where the votes are going to fall on this, but this is something a lot of people want,
including the governor. This puts this debate squarely in his lap. Full day kindergarten, or at least a targeted program, was one of the centerpieces of his budget proposal earlier this year. This is, I think you could argue, this is the one issue he's expended the most amount of energy on, you know, going around the state, talking to local chambers of commerce and political groups about the economic value of full-day kindergarten as a workforce attractor. You spoke to him this week after the Keno proposal came through, and he seemed measured, but I get the sense that
he wasn't putting his foot down about anything. That's what's been interesting about this, is he's sort of been open to whatever. Right. He wants kindergarten.
I think he sees
however.
This as a kind of as a campaign issue or a legacy issue for, you know, just a tangible, very popular policy outcome that he can point to and is willing to be flexible on it at this point.
Yeah, I think the governor's really shown kind of remarkable restraint and unusual restraint for him on this issue. And I think it's because it is so important to him. And I think he knows, and you get that sense at the State House. I don't know if this will ultimately be the case. There isn't going to be a Lucy with the football moment here, that Republicans in the Senate and the House want to do full day kindergarten in some form, and it's going to happen ultimately later this spring.
All right. Stay tuned for that one. But kindergarten wasn't the only policy bill that, you know, getting a lot of attention and getting a fair amount of support across the spectrum. The state Senate seems eager to make sure that the governor and state insurance regulators have flexibility to react should major changes to federal health care law come via either a budget or the American Health Care Act. You know, what's going on with that, Dean?
Well, you know, the issue here is that you know, in the face of uncertainty over the future of Obamacare, the bill that was passed by the U.S. House of Representatives, that was recently rescored by the Congressional Budget Office, and now will go on to the Senate, where they basically said they're going to start from scratch. There's a lot of uncertainty in these health insurance markets around the country. There are some states in which there's either one insurer or all the insurers are potentially pulling out. You know, part of that is a function of how the Trump administration responds to the need for subsidies to keep these markets going. You know, here in New Hampshire, we still have the same four, I believe, from last year are going to re-up for another year, which is pretty good in the grand scheme of what we've heard about some of these insurance markets. So the concern is to make sure there's flexibility to deal with the changing landscape.
I mean, it's going to be interesting to see what the rates end up being, and we're going
right.
to learn that
whether
shortly.
Or not they're going to go up, yeah.
You know, the governor did write the federal government recently urging continued subsidies
right. well,
for policies.
Part of the issue to keep them in.
Sold on the exchange, and, you know, the union leader published a report this week that may provide a glimpse and kind of a grim one about what folks might expect. You know, a draft document, presumably from the state or from an insurance carrier, talking about 44% premium increase, Kevin.
Right. And the insurance department also confirmed that all the insurance carriers lost millions and millions of dollars in this program in the last year, primarily driven by a couple of things. One, great utilization under Medicaid expansion, that folks were actually using health care, getting preventive health care, not going to the emergency room without insurance. That added costs and was greater utilization than they thought, but also the opioid epidemic and the huge costs that are incurred with those overdoses.
Well, obviously the future of Medicaid expansion in here is a very open question, but, you know, there is potentially some irony in that when the state crafted its plan, the New Hampshire Health Protection Act, not Medicaid expansion,
right.
For those out there who were set on calling it that, you know, there was a big stress on, well, we're going to get these folks onto private insurance and, you know, it seems like it's turning out that maybe that's costing people money.
Right. Rather than sticking with the Medicaid expansion as crafted by designed specifically under Obamacare, this sort of New Hampshire model that leaning on the private sector to provide that. Yeah. May well be part of the reason why we see those losses.
And, you know, against the backdrop of, you know, the Congressional Budget Office's scoring of the American Health Care Act, I mean, its future seems fairly questionable. I mean, according to the CBO, 23 million people could be without insurance over the next decade. So we'll see where that's going. I mean, it's clearly a very heated political issue. You look at what happened in Montana, you know, a couple of days ago. Now Congressman-elect Greg Gianforte, you know, was charged with assault after sort of tossing a reporter to the ground. Body slamming seems to be the operative term out there when he was asked to comment on the CBO score of the bill. And you know, healthcare wasn't an issue in a more local dispute between a reporter and a political entity. And I guess I'm talking now about the dispute between the Associated Press and the state Republican Party that's continuing to swirl. You know, this is a interesting glimpse into the moment. You know, Dan, what happened?
It goes back to last week. Trump advisor Kellyanne Conway was in the state speaking at the state GOP party's big fundraiser in Nashua. The party took the rather unusual step, they said, in collaboration with the White House to close the event to the press. Needless to say, there were still a lot of reporters at the event sort of milling around just trying to talk to people coming in and out. One of them was Melanie Plenda, who's been on the scene. She's been a freelance reporter in the state for a number of years, has written for a number of publications, including the Union Leader, New Hampshire, NHPR, was there covering for the AP. Her account was that she was invited in. She was sort of milling about the door, and a person there asked her to come in. Never asked if she was media. She filed a fairly, I'd say down the middle, fairly straight, fairly AP style report. She did underestimate the headcount, she claims, by accident. But what really
she said 150. The party says 400
plus. But state party communications director Patrick Hines and other, I imagine, other staff there turned up, among other things, at a Facebook post that Melanie had posted shortly after the election, in which she called for resistance and pushback to the impending Trump administration. They took issue with her underreporting and her reaction, her account of the crowd's reaction to some of Kellyanne Conway's comments, and basically went on a full-fledged kind of assault on her and the AP, sending out a fundraising letter, and essentially to our reporter, Case McDermott, doing the piece, or I think it was actually quoted in Breitbart, saying that the AP nationwide should be taken as a suspect news entity.
Well, why don't we listen to what Patrick Hines told NHPR about this?
This is not how journalism is done. You don't send liberal activists into an event for which they're not credentialed, they're not invited, and which is in fact closed to the press, to sneakily misreport on a story because you hate the president of the United States.
All right, that's Republican Party Communications Director Patrick Hines. And, you know, Kevin, you've been around a long time, dealt with all of these folks.
I was at the event. Yes, I was. Okay. I was outside the fundraiser and wrote a story about it because, frankly, our present publisher was quite interested that the Republican Party was closing to the press a speech by a major advisor of the White House. I mean, it's fairly unprecedented for that to happen. So we did a story about the protesters outside against Kellyanne Conway. We talked to Republicans who bought tickets to the event, didn't know it was closed to the press, and weren't happy to learn that it was closed to the press.
I mean, my recollection is sometimes these events, there'll be a private component
exactly.
and a public component
right.
where reporters can cover.
And even with that, Josh, you'll remember, I mean, during the presidential primary, when these candidates come in and there are these high roller events, there's a lot of negotiation that goes on with national press and state press about those receptions beforehand. And the negotiations sort of go like this. Make sure that candidate doesn't give extended remarks to the high rollers behind closed doors. And most of the time, that is honored because at the end of the day, New Hampshire's prides itself on open access, not just to the press, but to the public, to all of these events. That was obviously one of the reasons why we did the story.
Well, do you think in this climate that that a quick correction? The AP originally stood by its reporting, according to Patrick Hines, when the Republicans pointed out that there was a real disparity, factual error in terms of the number of people there. Do you think a quick correction would have snuffed this out?
It certainly would have limited the damage, to be sure. And it's clear, at least it seems to me, maybe other people on the panel disagree, but it seems to me AP completely changed its attitude toward this story once Pat Hines revealed the social media posts by Melanie. And I really find that unfortunate because she's not a liberal activist. She's a longtime journalist who's done a lot of straight reporting. And it's unfortunate her reputation has been tarnished in this way.
I think it ought to also be said that, you know, a Facebook post like that, regardless of meaning, she said she posted it privately, then it was spread more publicly, is ill-advised if you plan
Absolutely.
To work as a reporter.
Oh, sure.
Let me give you my reaction to it as a consumer of news. And I read the AP report right after the event. It was, you know, four paragraphs or something like that before any of this blew up. And my initial reaction to the article, I had two reactions. The first was the 150 50 count just struck me as low. Not even being at the event, I just said, boy, that's, I find that surprising. The second thing was there was a suggestion in the article that people did not react to Kelly right. Conway's snarky comments about Hillary Clinton. I also found that a little surprising yeah. For a Republican fundraiser. I mean, that sort of, that kind of red meat is what you do at fundraisers to get the party base fired up. So those things just struck me as odd before. And then the next day, all of this started to develop. I read the Facebook post. It's a pretty significant progressive call to arms, and it is right. ill-advised if you want to be a straight-down-the-middle reporter. I don't know if the AP knew about this. My guess is if they knew about it, they would not have assigned her to the story. It reinforces the narrative that journalists, as Breitbart ran with this, it's all over the place
sure.
now.
2,000-word story.
Yeah, it reinforces the narrative that you know, journalists have this sort of secret liberal agenda that they're pushing. And, well, and you know, I I mean, I'm not a reporter, but I have to wonder, sort of, can you really put up a wall between that kind of sort of Facebook activism and AP-style reporting? Well, I don't know. That's the question that's being raised.
Another question is, does the fact that this was the AP make this bigger? I mean, had this been, you know, somebody writing for a local media entity, you know, the AP obviously sure. bills itself as the largest news-gathering organization in the world, gives it a lot more oomph, and typically, you know, the AP does give a pretty straight...
I mean, they're sort of the foundation for many newsrooms. I mean, they fill a lot of holes... Yeah. I'd say almost every news organization in the country subscribes to it. Most of the news that you probably read is either an AP account or based off of one. and I think, you know, Dean raised some of the issues around the head count, excuse me, and the crowd's reaction. I think the party has a right to be unhappy with, you know, if they feel that the head count was underreported. This is often a soft spot, which is why, you know, I try to never estimate head counts. They were right if they felt that to quibble with her account of the crowd's reaction. And I think any of us who've reported have been on the receiving end of those phone calls, you know. But typically that's where it ends, that right. you can have that conversation, that someone from the party would have called up either Melanie or her editor at the AP. What's very unusual here is the real call to arms that the state party took to not only raise money but personally excoriate her and her editor. And I think the fact that it was the AP allowed it to mushroom into a national story. If she had just been reporting with the Keene Sentinel or the Monitor.
Part of the problem is some conservatives are suggesting that this was, you know, the AP intentionally doing this to kind of undermine Republican activism. And I don't know whether or not that's the case. They probably didn't know about this Facebook post. But, you know, all of this gets social media just sort of fires all this stuff up and magnifies it inevitably.
Why don't we take a listen to what Melanie Plenda told NHPR about this?
I've been a reporter for a really long time, and I've had sources get upset with me, and I've had people disagree with me, and usually I can talk it out with them, and I wouldn't be treated like that. And that was just I've never had that happen, and I think I guess that's what it's like to be a reporter now. You know, and it's frightening. It's very frightening.
All right, that's Melanie Plenda talking about essentially this incoming social media in the wake of the dispute over her coverage of Kellyanne Conway appearance. I mean, you know, you look at the events that have happened in the past month or so, you know, the body slamming of Ben Jacobs in Montana, a roll call reporter being pinned to the wall by security trying to ask an FCC commissioner a question, a reporter in West Virginia being arrested for trying to ask a question of Secretary of Health and Human Services Tom Price. You know, this incident's a little different in that it you know, part of it involves an acknowledged error by the reporter. But I mean, is it right to see these as emblematic of something larger, Kevin?
Well, it shouldn't come as any surprise that that supporters of Donald Trump are negative towards the press, since his entire presidential campaign was co-founded on the notion that the establishment media is part of the political elite and is always out to get conservatives and is the enemy of the state. So I'm not at all surprised since he's been elected that there's been an increased hostility out there on social media towards journalists.
Okay, and we're going to move on. One factual thing I want to get across is that apparently, according to Melanie Plenda, the AP has told her that she's no longer going to be covering any political events for her, which is probably appropriate in light of the Facebook post. Stick around. There's going to be more New Hampshire headlines on The Exchange's weekly New Hampshire News Roundup on NHPR.
Mm-hmm. Ideas come naturally to writers.
I wish.
But how are they with deadlines?
I would say probably 5 times in the history of my column have I gotten it done during the day on Monday. And it's the most incredible feeling. Like, if you could distill that feeling and grind it into a powder, I would snort it.
Apparently, they're just like the rest of us. Whether you're looking for inspiration or commiseration, subscribe to the 10-Minute Writer's Workshop on iTunes or Google Play.
This is the weekly New Hampshire News Roundup on The Exchange. I'm Josh Rogers, joined this week by Dan Barrick, NHPR, Kevin Landrigan, New Hampshire Union leader, Dean Spiliotis, Southern New Hampshire University. I want to now turn to another intersection of our local politics with the national moment, and that's playing out in Secretary of State Bill Gardner's appointment to be on what he's calling an election integrity panel. Democrats are trying to push to make sure that no state time or money should be used. You know, is this a gesture, or I mean, does it strike any of you that there's really any there in terms of this?
Well, I think if nothing else, it represents the way in which Bill Gardner has become a real flashpoint for anger among Democrats and liberals over this whole notion of voter fraud, and that he has either wittingly or unwittingly found himself at the center of this national. I mean, there's been a lot of discussion nationally, a lot of it fueled by the president about alleged rampant voter fraud. But on the state level, SB3, the Senate bill that would, depending on your view, either tighten up or restrict voting rights for certain types of residents, largely would fall on folks who either part-time residents or college students. He's really been at the center of this in a way that and it's been kind of hard to understand sometimes his motives or his true views here. He said that his interest in – he does not believe that there's widespread voter fraud in New Hampshire. He said his interest in participating in the president's panel is to at least be part of the process and not necessarily to uncover widespread instances of illegal voting. But that's still, you know, the Democrats are still very, very, very unhappy with the way the voting reform effort's been playing out here on the state level. And he represents that.
I mean, certainly he said essentially that he doesn't believe there's a problem, but he believes that people believe there's a problem. So that might be fought.
Right. And that's certainly as someone who's covered Bill Gardner for a long time, Josh, you know, he cares a great deal about how the public views the electoral process. And he's certainly seen since 2000, Bush v. Gore, a growing voter distrust of elections being valid. And I think that's one of the reasons why he agreed to serve on this commission. Is there a way at the federal level we can create more voter trust in the process as it exists now? And certainly, I think it's why he's come over time to support this notion of a residency requirement in the state of New Hampshire, where college students could qualify to vote as residents in New Hampshire if they've been here 30 days, but that voters would see that if someone was here for 30 days, there's no drive-by voting. There's no people who really don't live here or have no intention of staying here or don't even live here for a short period of time, yet they can grab a ballot and vote.
Well, another thing with the Secretary of State is, you know, while he did serve in the legislature a long time ago as a Democrat, I think it's fair to see him as somewhat, you know, in his own category at this point, you know, given how many terms he's been in Secretary of State. And, you know, Republicans always like to mention when they're talking about election law things that Democrats don't agree with that the Secretary of State may agree with. Well, you know, Bill Gardner's a Democrat. He agrees with it. And, you know, over time, you can certainly see a lot of frustration, particularly with, you know, Democratic partisans, lawyers representing Democratic interests on election law issues with the Secretary of State. You know, one thing that this letter from Minority Leader Steve Shurtleff to the Secretary of State did ask is that no state resources be used. I think the ledger would reflect that, you know, Bill Gardner's been pretty good at using federal resources for state functions, if you look at Help America Vote Act dollars. But, you know, the Secretary of State has been out of town this week, and so I was told by his staff that he was very eager to talk about this, but, you know, wouldn't return. I think he was getting back today. So I guess we'll see what he says and where this goes. But, you know, the all politics is national mood can even be seen in the most parochial of matters these days. And in this, I'm talking about New Hampshire House special elections. There were two of those this week, and you know, in Wolfboro, Edie Damaris beaten Republican Matthew Panch in a, you know, by 4 percentage points. That's 56 votes. And, you know, apparently Democrats haven't won a House seat out of Wolfboro since the early part of the, you know, 20th century.
Yeah.
You know, I have to say I laughed a little bit when I saw this race being cited as a big bellwether by national news outlets, Dean.
I have to tell you, from within minutes of the flip being announced, I got inundated with calls and emails from people around the country, reporters who wanted to know, is this the beginning of the Trump backlash? And, you know, how much should we read into this? And it's remarkable now the way this stuff just gets bounced around with social media. And, you know, I mean, this is one state House seat. There are local factors on the ground in terms of the particular representative being well known in the community. You know, it is interesting that this has basically been a Republican seat forever. But it was just fascinating to me to watch how quickly, with this and a couple of other state seats that are at least one other, I think, in New York that had
flipped.
Where it was just suddenly, you know, just the sort of the level of analysis based on a small N or a small number of observations was really, really remarkable.
I mean, you even saw DNC Chair Tom Perez send out, you know, a statement on this. I think it's emblematic of how eager Democrats are for something, for some kind of signal that the tide is moving in their direction.
Yeah.
But again, you know, it's in Wolfboro. Yes, it is a rock-ribbed Republican town, but it was, you know, what we're talking 1,500 votes. Damaris won by I think 50 or so. I think, Kevin, as you pointed out in your reporting, she had run for a long time at a child care center in town. Which
is a very good
Yeah, anyone who has kids in daycare knows that person is often a central part of your life.
Like it or not.
But and it's, you know, New Hampshire House is a New Hampshire House, and special elections are often, you know, outliers. But, you know, Democrats will certainly take it, and they have every right to run with it, if you know, because it's tangible. It's an outcome.
I mean, it ought to be noted that Republican Mark McClain defeated Democrat James Moran in the race in Manchester to fill the seat left by the death of Steve Valancourt. You know, the race that a lot of people are going to be paying attention to shortly is the state Senate special election to fill the seat left by the death of Scott McGilvery. And, you know, it'll be interesting to see how much money flows in. You know, that's a district that could potentially...
That's a true bellwether. I mean, that's a district that McGilvery, a Democrat, won it in November. It had been held by David Booten, a fairly moderate Republican before that, who's actually now running again. There's a Democratic primary. So, you know, Jim Dorman and Kevin Kavanaugh. Kavanaugh seems to have garnered the lion's share of endorsements and support and momentum. But I do think that one would be a more legitimate indication of voter sentiment in New Hampshire in 2017.
I mean, obviously, any first term of a new president, you know, the opposing party tends to do well in midterms. And, you know, we are starting to see, you know, we have an all-Democratic, you know, delegation at the moment. We are certainly starting to see developments in the first congressional district where Carol Shea Porter, you know, due to national forecasters are saying she's in a better position than she, you know, typically has been. Eddie Edwards, former liquor enforcement chief, is sending out lots of releases, town and grassroots backing. You know, we've alluded to this, that there's speculation that State Senator Andy Sanborn, you know, may be running in that race, and that may, you know, be a factor in some of his strong stances on revenue. You know, I have to say that primary would be a hard-fought one, and likely, you know, they wouldn't be the only folks in this thing, Kevin.
No, certainly former Health and Human Services Commissioner and former nominee for governor and Congress, this particular seat, John Stephen of Manchester, is giving a serious look at this. We've got former Republican Vice Chairman Matt Mabry of Dover is also considering it. This is the marquee race for Republicans in 2018. This is the race they think where they can actually make a pickup here in New Hampshire and change what's an all-Democratic congressional delegation. When we talk about money, this is where all the national money on the Republican side will go in 2018.
Yeah, you know, the argument has been that for Democrats hoping to take back the U.S. Senate, that the map isn't quite as good for them as it might otherwise have been. But the House of Representatives, obviously, the seats are all up every 2 years, so you do have opportunity for swings in seats. And if you look at the last three midterms, you know, 2006, you have a Republican president. It's the Democratic tsunami. Nancy Pelosi becomes Speaker of the House. 2010 is a Tea Party rebellion. Republicans take over the House of Representatives. The Democratic president Obama. 2014.
And Frank Ginta won in 2014,
the Republicans win the Senate back. So, you know, the recent historical record is not good for the party controlling the White House. That's the way it's been for the most case. I mean, the last 2002, in the wake of 9/11, you had a little bit of a rally effect around George Bush, but that was basically it. These midterms are not great for the party that controls the White House. So I think that's one reason why you're seeing the Shea Porter's congressional district one. I think it was moved from toss up to lean to like slightly Democratic or lean Democratic in some of the ratings.
I mean, there's plenty of time for that to thrash around, obviously.
Sure.
But you know, one person who is not going to be running for office again in New Hampshire in the foreseeable future is former Massachusetts Senator and New Hampshire GOP Senate nominee Scott Brown, who's been confirmed to serve as ambassador to New Zealand, which strikes me as not a bad gig to have. Scott Brown was obviously an early backer of President Trump, who used to refer to Brown as someone who, quote, looked like a vice president out of central casting, which may or may not be a compliment. But in any case, Scott Brown is going to be heading to New Zealand. Let's step away from politics in New Hampshire and talk a little bit about Vermont Governor Phil Scott's vetoing of a bill to legalize recreational marijuana. Vermont would have been the first state and, you know, still may yet be the first state to do it via the legislature and not via referendum. You know, Dan, how significant is Phil Scott's move? He's a Republican.
Well, if he had allowed that become law or signed it, it would have left New Hampshire as surrounded by every neighboring state around us have legalized marijuana. Maine and Massachusetts, as you indicated, did it by referendum and have yet to actually implement it there. But it would have changed significantly the landscape here in New Hampshire. There's a decriminalization bill that looks like it's likely to become law here in New Hampshire. So I don't know if Vermont putting into law full legalization would have upped the ante for New Hampshire in the near future. But if nothing else, it at least makes it clear that we're on a track. And we've seen this with other social issues, you know, with the gay marriage debate, where we went pretty quickly from a very fraught debate over over civil unions to, very quickly passing full marriage. And in that case, again, we were sort of tailing somewhat our New England neighbors here. I don't know if marijuana is the same thing, but it certainly,
civil unions, I think we were in the same position in Vermont as being the first state to do it by legislative means, what they're facing with marijuana. And I'm not terribly privy to the inner workings of the Vermont State House. It did strike me that Phil Scott's statement wasn't a kind of hell no, this sends the wrong message and this is horrendous. This is, you know, practical concerns about being able to tell with people impaired for driving. Kevin, did it strike you as this was just the politics of Vermont and, you know, maybe increasingly the politics of New Hampshire, if you believe the polls are tilting heavily towards marijuana legalization?
Yeah, no, I think it was the politics of a new Republican governor who's still trying to get his feet underneath him in a state that obviously usually trends Democratic. So Governor Phil Scott wants to be very cautious about, like Dan was saying, becoming a national figure in the progressive agenda of recreational use of marijuana.
All right. I want to turn to the bears in the woods and in the yards and in the houses of Hanover, apparently. Family of bears, Fish and Game's position is that once bears get habituated to, having their way with bird feeders and, getting their way into people's kitchens, you pretty much need to kill them. Governor Sununu has come out and said, we will not kill the bear. That's what he said in Portsmouth yesterday. In a statement this morning that we got from him, he said, a spokesman said that Governor Sununu has spoken to Fish and Game and they are working on seeing what alternatives are available to resolve the situation. Fish and Game had been pretty clear about this, Kevin. I mean, is this going to be a political test for the governor?
Well, I think it reflects this governor's personality, which is to say he's very responsive to what the people in the state are talking about and are interested about. And we've seen this before. And he's not necessarily wedded to, hard and fixed positions. I'm against Election Day registration, remember, during the campaign. I opposed the Medicaid expansion. Now he's kind of on board with Medicaid expansion in some form. And here, usually governors trust the scientists in Fish and Game, but he got his office got absolutely deluged with calls, texts, messages about this, and he essentially is trying to find a way out. Is there a safe way to release these bears?
Yeah, it's amazing. You know, as soon as this story hit the web and I read it, I said, this is going to be fascinating to watch the reaction to this, because, you know, the article said we have these, you know, these cuddly bear cubs and this mom, and we're going to euthanize them and shoot them. And I said, as soon as that gets around, it's going to be a firestorm of a reaction. You know, I learned about bears and bird feeders the hard way when I first moved here many years ago. I lived in the Upper Valley, and like my first weekend, we put a bird feeder out, and a bear opened it like a can of baked beans. And so I learned that you have to take them down, and you know, people have to be careful with trash. I have friends who have had bears end up in their screen porches because the grill has drippings. That so you have to sort of learn how
that's,
to.
That's actually one of the interesting angles here. One of our reporters talked to the town manager in Hanover, who put the blame squarely on Dartmouth students for leaving food scraps and trash around, which, you know, coming off the heels of the school's
bear branding and
but I mean, you know, when this story was raised in our news meeting, I'm assuming the reaction was similar to people around the state, which was, really, you got to kill them? I mean, it's not something most people think about, but as Kevin said, you know, the folks who study, who work with bears, who understand the behavior, say it's an unfortunate but necessary step here. We'll see what this what the governor's, you know, sort of working with language about fish and game will yield. If he can manage some kind of non-lethal outcome, I do think that would be certainly something that would earn him a lot of credit.
Well, there are some
voters.
People, I mean, Fish and Game has its position. There are some people, Ben Killam, who's written books about dealing with bears, who lives in Lyme, I believe, has said that he thinks there's a way this could be handled.
Yeah, one of the things about this, the calendar now, is we're near the breeding season. So the female typically would send their cubs away at this time of year. And Ben essentially says, so we're coming up to a point where it's conceivable you could release these bears separately and the mother would not aimlessly go for miles and miles and try and find the cubs.
All right.
Kevin Landry knows everything, including bear breeding
bear
season.
Bear mating biology.
Okay. All right. He contains multitudes.
He does.
So, all right. We're almost out of time. You know, next week, the budget's going to the floor. We'll see what happens with Keno and kindergarten. That's what I'm going to be looking at. What about you, Kevin?
We're focusing on this Democratic primary for the state Senate that Dan talked about. There's some real differences on key issues like commuter rail. And again, as Dan spoke about, the establishment behind one candidate and not behind the other who held office in the legislature and the executive council.
I'm not anticipating any uproar, but just keep an eye on the Senate as they take up the budget next week.
What about you, Dean?
Yeah, absolutely. Seeing the outcome with the budget and also these congressional races, the state senate race, it's really interesting to see this stuff heating up. One's a special election, but the other is even talking about congressional races at this point is really interesting.
All right, this is the weekly New Hampshire News Roundup on the Exchange. I'm Josh Rogers. Have a good weekend, all.
The views expressed in this program are those of the individuals and not those of NHPR, its Board of Trustees, or its underwriters. Hey, if you like what you heard, spread the word. Please give us a review on iTunes to help other listeners find us. And thanks.